Marx and Engels provided the theory and the utopian vision. Lenin and Stalin, for better or usually for worse, provided the test case. For the past century, socialist and communist political leaders around the world have followed Lenin's example as they implemented their versions of a workers' paradise in which the predatory ruling class is overthrown and the louche bourgeoisie is elbowed aside. Even during the Stalinist years, the Soviet Union had many admirers among Western intellectuals, artists, labor and civil rights activists, and dreamers who just wanted a better world or an alternative to capitalism. The disasters of communism that followed are familiar enough. The millions of people who died under Mao Zedong, Cambodia, where millions were slaughtered by the Khmer Rouge in the infamous killing fields, and the Kim dynasty of North Korea. And yet communism and socialism outside the Soviet Union run a spectrum that defies easy categorization. Not surprising when you consider that in the 1970s, more than a third of the world's population was under communist rule, and many Western countries had social democratic governments built around progressive taxation and state-run services such as universal health care. We're going to discuss the varieties of communist and socialist experience with two guests this morning. Kristen Godsey is a professor of Russian and East European Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies the lived experience of communism and post-communism in Eastern Europe. She's an award-winning author whose latest book is Red Hangover, Legacies of 20th Century Communism, and she's in a studio in Philadelphia. And Lucan Wei, he's a professor of political science at the University of Toronto, who studies authoritarianism, democracy, and post-communist states. He's the co-chair of the editorial board of the Journal of Democracy and the author of Competitive Authoritarianism, Hybrid Regimes After the Cold War. He joins me from a studio this morning in Berkeley, California. Hello and welcome both of you to the Sunday edition. Hi.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. I want to start by asking you each a question. Lucan, if I can put it to you first. If the Russian Revolution was in fact a test case, how does the history of the Soviet Union color the way we think about communism and socialism today?
A great deal. I mean, it certainly provided the first example of a full-fledged communist state. And I think that as Lenin envisioned it, communism was fundamentally antithetical to democracy. And in that sense, it, you know, destroyed any hopes of democracy in Russia in 1917.
Krista, what do you think? You've written that for many people, quote, socialism equals Stalinism. Is that fair?
No, I don't think that's fair. I think that many people reduce all sort of ideologies of socialism and communism and left ideologies more broadly to the horrors of Stalinism, which I think is kind of a simplistic notion. If you look at the situation in Russia in 1917, they were coming off of a world war. They then had a civil war and a very large famine.
Right.
Lenin decided to take the party in a very non-democratic way, but there were plenty of socialists, chief among them Rosa Luxemburg in Germany, who was very much opposed to Lenin's idea of instituting the dictatorship of the proletariat. There was a deep impulse towards democracy very early on in socialist thinking. It just got superseded by the Russian Revolution and the rise of the Bolsheviks.
Is there any way of coming to grips with a working definition today, in light of the legacy of the Soviet Union, of what we mean by socialist and communist? Kristen, can I ask you?
I think that would be tricky because there are so many permutations of the ideology going back again to its foundations in the 19th century. You have democratic socialists, you have social democrats, you've got communists, you've got anarchists, you've got anarcho-syndicalists. Some people believe that socialism means progressive taxation and redistribution. Other people believe it requires state ownership of the means of production.
Well, are there any countries that have become communist or purely socialist who took Marxism in a path utterly independent of the influence of Trotsky and Lenin and Stalin? Lukin?
Certainly the social democracies in Northwest Europe. I mean, I think there are certainly many countries in that part of the world that call themselves socialists that are very democratic. But I think typically those are countries that have called themselves communist, you know, really defined by complete state control over the economy.
Although the one really interesting exception would be Finland, where you have a very large communist party. You always have since the Finnish Civil War in 1918. And the communist party there has been democratically participating in politics for the better part of the last century. And that has sort of had a very strong impact on the shape of social democracy in Finland. But Finland is very much still a democratic country and has always been democratic country.
And I would actually add that communist parties, when they're not in power, in opposition in Latin America, have performed a very important role in terms of promoting pluralism. I think that's the case. But I think for the most part, when communist parties have come to power, it's very hard to find an example of a democratic outcome.
Kristen, you said that one of the reasons for the success of communism in various parts of the world is its flexibility. What did you mean by that?
Marx had a theoretical text, but when we talk about, for instance, communism in Eastern Europe, what we're really talking about is Marxist-Leninism. When we talk about communism or state socialism in Yugoslavia, it's really kind of Titoism. And we look at China, it's Maoism, whether it be in Vietnam or Cuba or Nicaragua. All of these countries sort of took aspects of socialist ideologies and implemented them in a variety of different ways.
But they also did involve many very similar ingredients. They all had single-party rule, the complete destruction of any kind of pluralism, for the most part, total state control over the economy.
Well, all right, you raise the question of China. Let's look at that for a moment. The Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, is consolidating power around himself. He's, of course, disdainful of democratic rights and freedom and so on, but he's a big booster of high-powered capitalism in a country with lots of billionaires. How is that communist?
I don't think that's really communist. I think it's ruled by the Communist Party.
Absolutely. I mean, I think China would be really better characterized as a state capitalist country in the sense that I think a lot of times people in the West conflate democracy and capitalism, and one is a political system and one is an economic system. And you can have a capitalist economy that is not democratic, and certainly you could have a democratic socialist economy where the government owns a lot of the industry. So I think that China has evolved since the end of the Cold War in a much more capitalistic direction, for sure.
You said you wrote...
But certainly not democratic.
Well, yeah.
Not democratic, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And Kirsten, you said that the Cold War, in fact, led the West, us, to believe that capitalism equates with freedom. And that's not necessarily the case. Is that it?
Well, I certainly think that the Cold War dichotomy between East and West, particularly as it was experienced by people living on both sides of the Iron Curtain, tended to conflate a kind of ideology of democracy and capitalism and free markets equal freedom. And I think that if you look at the experience of many of the East European countries, what you find is that they got capitalism. They didn't really get democracy. There's a lot of corruption. These are fairly unstable systems, as we can see in places like Hungary and Poland turning towards illiberal forms of democracy. Obviously, Russia is another example.
I guess I would disagree slightly. I certainly think that you can have capitalism and autocracy, but I think the end to state control over the economy, the sort of defining feature of Marxist-Leninist communism, was essential to the creation of any form of democracy. And I think by sort of normal political science definitions in the 1990s, most of East Central Europe was democratic. They had widespread civil liberties, fair and free elections and the like. It's definitely in trouble now, but I think on the political end, what happened in Eastern Europe was quite positive.
There's always been the argument that perhaps the Russian Revolution took place in the wrong country. Maybe it should have been in Germany or someplace in Europe. Was communism just tried in wrong countries, Kristen? Is that possible?
If you talked to kind of dyed-in-the-wool Marxists, they will definitely tell you that Marx imagined that these revolutions would happen in the most advanced capitalist countries. You had to go through the stage of capitalism before you got to socialism, and then eventually you would get to communism where the state would wither away. Russia was a very poor, backward, feudal country in 1917. It was not an ideal candidate by any stretch of the imagination for the kind of communist revolution that Marx was imagining.
You've written, if communism failed, it was because its ideals were betrayed by the leaders who were supposedly speaking on its behalf, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. The people who came into power in many of these East European countries were not, or, and certainly this is true in many of the developing countries of the global South, these were not the ideal communist leaders by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, you look at all communist states that have emerged. I mean, I think that they exhibit many of the similar problems of shortage economy and the like. So I wouldn't go too far in attributing, you know, the failures to a particular leadership style.
Although, again, we see differences with people like Tito in Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia had a much more robust economy. They were much more open to the West. And so it was a functioning economy for a while until the war and the whole country fell apart. But that had to do in some ways with leadership styles and the difference between what was called self-managing socialism or Titoism versus a kind of much more hardcore Stalinist model.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to reach for is the question of whether it was a good idea that went wrong, or that it was a bad idea from the beginning?
Well, I think that communism was primarily good in terms of critique of capitalism.
Right.
And that's, I think, you know, where I would still, you know, find something to agree with. I think as an economic system, I would say it totally failed. Again, I think it's important to recognize that it did allow Russia to rapidly industrialize. And it was also, in the 60s and 70s, very much considered a model for many developing countries who also wanted to rapidly industrialize. At the same time,
Absolutely.
It really created, at its core, in the, you know, the fundamental design flaws that led to, you know, shortage economy, led to sort of enormous amounts of repression and destruction of pluralism that I think are really essential, even to the idea, not that it was sort of incorrectly implemented, if that's what you're suggesting.
But it was doomed to be authoritarian, was it?
Absolutely.
You think? Kristen, do you agree with that?
Well, then you would have to say that the, how do you account for Norway and Sweden and Denmark and Iceland and Finland, the countries that are very socialistic in their policies? They don't have central planning in the, to the same extent. But in terms of thinking about the way that capitalism accumulates profits and then concentrates those profits into a small group of people, and over time that group of people becomes smaller and smaller and richer and richer, I agree that the critique of Marx of the capitalist system and the way that it exploits the working classes is still quite salient today. Now, I agree that the way that communism was implemented in Eastern Europe was pretty much overwhelmingly a failure. These countries really did devolve very quickly into authoritarianism, and it was very difficult to imagine how they could have reversed. Although I think it is important to remind ourselves that Gorbachev's policies of perestroika and glasnost in the 80s were aimed at kind of trying to address some of these problems, as were the policies of the Czech communist in the lead up to the Prague Spring in 1968.
Yep.
These were themselves communists trying to reform their countries to be less authoritarian and more flexible to the market. Now, they failed, but I think it's important to remember that Gorbachev himself saw the flaws in the Soviet Union and tried to correct them before the whole thing came tumbling down around him.
I would just say that the experience of Gorbachev, you know, in which he fundamentally sought to weaken the Communist Party when he destroyed the Communist Party, I don't think it's accidental that the Soviet Union collapsed. I think it was pretty much an inevitable result of that.
Let me ask the both of you, because we can remember that after the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the breakup of the Soviet Union, that was supposed to be the end of history. The Cold War was over and capitalism won and democracy would flourish and so on. What is your opinion, each of you, of this mood of triumphalism around the end of communist Europe?
Well, I think that, you know, there definitely was a mood of triumphalism. The positive end of this triumphalism was that it discredited old arguments that democracy could only, you know, take place or survive in a certain set of limited countries in the West. I think I probably agree with Kirsten that, on the other hand, the sort of more negative side of triumphalism is that it led to a convergence of the center-left with the right in terms of neoliberal economic policies around free trade and deregulation that I think, you know, indirectly has contributed to the rise of populism today.
Kristen, what's your take on that?
I've written extensively about the suffering of ordinary people
right.
after the fall of communism in 1989. And, you know, there was a spate in 2013 of people self-immolating in Bulgaria to protest the poverty and corruption that has followed in the wake of the collapse of communism. And I think There was a lot of triumphalism. I think the Western governments should have been a little bit more thoughtful about what they were doing. They dismantled these large welfare state economies incredibly quickly. The people in these countries who might have perhaps chosen a more social democratic model, on the example of some Scandinavian countries, this was just never really on the table. It was mostly a kind of neoliberal capitalism, total free markets, you know, really austerity of the state. I think there's a lot of economic suffering and frustration happening in this part of the world, and we could have done, you know, the leaders of Western countries in the 90s particularly could have been a little bit more delicate in dealing with the transition process.
We were too busy patting ourselves on the back, weren't we, for winning the Cold War?
If I may break in, I mean, yeah. I'm a little reluctant to sort of blame the economic downturn in Eastern Europe purely on neoliberalism. I mean, look at countries like Ukraine, which never implemented any kind of neoliberal policy, which had, you know, massive economic collapse. And, you know, and also I can tell you, because I worked in the World Bank in the 1990s, a lot of these countries simply didn't follow these policies. And I think it kind of overestimates the power of neoliberal thinkers like Jeffrey Sachs and the like.
Let me ask, Lucan, why, in your view, why the popularity for socialism? It has a tremendous appeal, especially among academics, but you have the appeal of Corbyn in the UK and Bernie Sanders in the United States last year. What is the appeal? Why is it still popular?
Well, I think because the current system of capitalism, with its incredible inequalities and very uneven distribution of resources, creates a lot of losers, and people want some kind of alternative. And I think I actually don't really agree with a lot of the policies of Jeremy Corbyn and the like, but I do think it's a positive development that we're sort of breaking out of this kind of neoliberal consensus and that the left is starting to be left again.
Let me ask you finally, is it possible, can either of you imagine a form of communism that would not be authoritarian? It would be democratically elected and legitimized by the popular will, or, as you said earlier, Lucan, that Marxism is great as a critique of capitalism, but it's pretty lousy as a political system.
When I said that, I really was referring to Marxist-Leninism as being fundamentally antithetical to democracy. I mean, clearly, as Kirsten said, it's pretty unfair to tar Jeremy Corbyn with Stalinism. The answer certainly does not lie in Marxism-Leninism. I think that's fundamentally autocratic, but I think there are other forms of left that emerged, you know, out of the Mensheviks in Russia in 1917 that are, you know, quite compatible with democracy.
Kirsten, last word to you.
Yeah, I think that the key thing about these left ideas is that the state should be accountable to the needs of the people, of the constituents of the state. I mean, that is a kind of fundamentally democratic model. We understand in the United States that wealthy people use the state to serve their interests.
Sure.
And I think people like Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, their really radical idea is that ordinary people should use the state to promote their interests.
Yeah.
That's essentially what we're talking about, right? Now, this is not Marxist-Leninism, as Lucan points out, which is a very specific form of that idea. But you can do this democratically. And we've seen very good examples of this in countries in Scandinavia, where people have voted their economic interests to increase taxation, to redistribute. The Norwegian government owns the largest financial institutions in that country, and that's not antithetical to democracy.
Isn't it in your constitution that the state has to provide for the common welfare? That sounds a bit...
Right, and we have, like, libraries and roads and national... We have a lot of things, you know, public education. It's not such a radical idea when you break it down and say that ordinary people vote, they elect governments that represent their interests. That's not a crazy idea.
No.
That's a pretty basic fundamental point of democracy, it seems. But it somehow gets tarred with the legacies of 20th century communism. And I think that that's partially intentional on the part of elites who stand to lose if we increase tax rates or limit their opportunities for profit making.
And we managed to get through our entire conversation without mentioning the name Donald John Trump, which I think is great.
That's pretty remarkable.
Thank you. Thank you both. It's great to meet you on the radio.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
My guest this morning, Kristin Godsey. She's professor of Russian and East European Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her new book is called Red Hangover, Legacies of 20th Century Communism. This morning she was in the studio in Philadelphia. And Lucan Way, he's professor of political science at the University of Toronto. He's the co-chair of the editorial board of the Journal of Democracy, and he is the author of Competitive Authoritarianism, Hybrid Regimes After the Cold War. This morning he was in a studio in Berkeley, California. You're listening to the Sunday edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across North America on Sirius XM Radio. My name is Michael Enright.